You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. I love this headline from the Borowitz Report. GOP, Republicans report, right? Evil mastermind behind Benghazi is frail old woman with brain damage. It's like, you think you can't? They can't have it both ways, can they? I don't know. Maybe they can. Who knows? I don't know. There's a lot in the news that we're going to be getting to today as time goes on. In particular, fast food workers, they're still out there saying, hey, $15 an hour, let's do that. But one of the real issues in America is an infrastructure issue, and that's our educational infrastructure. What are we going to do about our educational infrastructure? What are we going to do about, although our public schools right now have the highest graduation rate in the history of the United States, the highest literacy rate upon graduation in the history of the United States, the highest going on to college rate in the history of the United States, almost bumped up against by just after World War II with the GI Bill, which kind of distorted things because everybody could go to college for free. But still, you know, they're doing well. And yet, as we talked about last week, you know, with some of the Brown v. Board stuff, I mean, there are still schools that are not doing well, that are failing. And very often there seems to be a component of a race component associated with that. So what do we do about that? Neil McCluskey is on the line with us. He's the associate director with the Center for Educational Freedom at the former Charles Koch Institute, now known as the Cato Institute, author of Feds in the Classroom, How Big Government Corrupts, Cripples, and Compromises American Education, the website cato.org. Hey, Neil.
How you doing?
I'm well. Good. You know, I read your piece, and it seems, tell me if I'm wrong, it seems like you don't think that the business of the government, you said, you know, even George Washington wasn't in favor of this. I'm not sure if you know about Thomas Jefferson and the University of Virginia, but and I'm not sure also it would be all that productive to get into a debate about 1797 or 1806. But it seems to me that you think that we should not have government schools, that the schools are not part of the commons, that we shouldn't be collectively paying for the education of our children. Do I have that right?
Well, I mean, what I wrote, especially regards to Brown v. Board, is that it's very clear that right now we have a system where lots of people have school choice, but they're generally wealthy people who choose a school by being able to buy an expensive house. And what I said is, look, we need to fund education differently. We need to attach money to students and then give their parents real power to go to a school because they have the money attached to them. It's not sent to a specific school, and they can choose a school. Rather than we say to people, especially low-income people, sorry, if you want to get to a good school, you have to be able to buy a house in a good district.
And, right, and so I you're talking about vouchers here. You're talking about vouchers here, right?
Well, it can be vouchers. My preference is that we have donation tax credits where you donate to a scholarship granting organization, and then they give scholarships. And the reason that's preferable is you can choose whether or not you want to donate. You can choose who you want to donate to, and then you're not being compelled necessarily to send a child to a school you may not like.
Long ago and far away, I went to public school, and it was a block away from my house and my elementary school. And it was a great school. I got a great education. There was, you know, this was in the 1950s. There was no debate about, gee, he should have a choice. There was a Catholic school that was about a quarter mile away. I could have gone to had I been Catholic. But the Catholic school, pretty much the only people who went there were Catholics. It wasn't like people were trying to flee the public schools. What we're seeing now is this explosion of private for-profit schools. And it seems typically that when advocates of, quote, school choice, end quote, like yourself, come on programs like this or others, what you're really talking about is somebody ought to be able to make a buck off education. And that doesn't seem to me like a reasonable thing. It seems to me that education should be part of our public commons. And you're explicitly saying it's not, that our government, you know, it's not, you said education's not mentioned in the Constitution. I mean, which brings up Alexander Hamilton's objection to even having a Bill of Rights attached to the Constitution. He felt that people might think these are the only things that we honor, when in fact, you know, the beginning, the first and the last paragraphs of Article 1, Section 8 are incredibly all-inclusive, as is the preamble. I don't get it. I just don't get it. Why, instead of saying our public schools in some cases, particularly in those neighborhoods where they're paid for with property taxes and there's such poverty that the schools suck because they got no money, why, instead of saying, therefore, we should give people a voucher and let some guy come in and run a private school and make a buck off this, why don't we simply fund the schools we have appropriately? Why don't we come up with a better funding mechanism for them?
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned the Catholic schools, and particularly when we combine this with the Brown v. Board anniversary, which is that it's very clear that public schools, government schools, didn't serve huge segments of the population, clearly. They didn't serve, certainly not equally, African Americans for a long time after they were allowed even to use the public schools. And Catholics established a huge Catholic schooling system because the public schools were de facto Protestant institutions.
Well,
if we really want a system,
so, I mean, if you want to go back to
really want a system
Horace
that
Mann.
Is fair to everybody, you connect money to kids and let them choose schools, not say you really have to use the system that hasn't treated people equally through most of its history.
Well, I will give you that Horace Mann in the 1880s, pitched public schools to the good people of Massachusetts as a way of breaking the back of the Catholic immigrants in Boston, and that the Catholic schools came about at that point in time as a reaction to that, and this all came out of the Know Nothing Society, and I'm assuming you know this history, but I don't see what that has to do with today. I don't understand why we're not having a conversation about appropriately funding public schools so that there is no need for choice, this so-called choice. I mean, why not have all of our schools in America be as good as all the schools? I mean, I lived in Germany for a year. There's no discussion about school choice. We did our show for 2 weeks from Denmark, and we visited a bunch of their schools. They have among the best educational outcomes in the world. No need for choice. There's not even a discussion about it. Why? Because their public schools work.
Actually,
why don't we simply make all of our public schools work?
There's no discussion about it now in most European countries, because most European countries, you have choice. You can choose a religious school, a Protestant school, a Catholic school, a non-religious school, and they.
But the fact of the matter is that public schools are not failing.
Centuries of conflict over religion. And
sure.
what I'm saying is, not only should we empower people to choose schools because it really gives them power in the system.
No, I disagree. First of all, Neil,
when we
respectfully,
ask people, they have
if you're talking about
desires.
Giving, no, if you're talking about taking my tax dollars and giving it to a parent so that they can send their kids to a religious school, I'm totally opposed to that.
Well, I know you're totally opposed to
I think it's a violation of the First Amendment. This is why James Madison vetoed this. It was the first veto of his presidency.
You really need to look into this history a little deeper, because for one thing, Horace Mann was in the 1830s. And it's so clear when you look at American schooling history that huge swaths of people simply were unserved or even served adversely by the public school system. If you look abroad, school choice is the norm. Now, often there's national standards, but you choose what sort of school you want to go
to. No, you're distorting what I'm saying.
Yes, people can
choose to send their kids to a religious school, but A, the government is not paying for it.
In Europe it is.
No.
Absolutely is. Look up almost any European country, including places like Sweden, which you think of as sort of the Scandinavian belt buckle of the welfare state, and you'll find that...
Well, they don't have a First Amendment. I don't think we should be. Well, you know, I mean, if you want to use Sweden as the example. Anyhow, Neil, we're out of time. I think we both made our points. Neil McCluskey, hang on just a second, Neil. We're going to get stepped on here.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Neil McCluskey, he is the Associate Director for the Center for Educational Freedom over at the Cato Institute, cato.org, the website. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks.
Good talking. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Andrew Campbell, senior producer with The Big Picture, is on the line with us. Hey, Andrew, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure, Andrew. So we're going to start out with the fast food workers. I want to get into this in a few minutes here on the program. Their fast food protesters demand could cost nearly half a million fast food workers' jobs? Is this the seriously? David Selig is saying this?
Well, he's echoing the sentiments of Michael Saltzman, who is the research director at the Employment Policies Institute, or EPI, and they released a report last week saying that the nationwide fight for a $15 minimum wage in the fast food industry could be counterproductive, and that it would defy common sense by making even more fast food workers be without jobs because they simply wouldn't be employed. Because the EPI believes that hiring would slow down and really no one would be able to pay this $15 wage.
Okay. Andrew, you need to get over to prwatch.org and look up EPI. This is incredible. This the headline is Corporate America's New Scam, PR Firm Poses as Think Tank.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen other reports in the last few months from EPI. It's
this is actually
a very skewed organization.
It's not even an organization.
Yeah.
They operate out of Berman & Company's offices, Richard Berman. Richard Berman used to be a lobbyist for the tobacco industry, the alcohol industry. 60 Minutes called him Dr. Evil. And he spent several years as an executive at Steak and Ale in the restaurant industry. And he has, and it's not EPI, it's EPIF. It's the Employment Policies Institute Foundation. They call themselves EPI so that people will confuse them with the Economic Policy Institute, which actually has 20 staff and 36 respected researchers. This EPIF has basically one guy who is a PR shill, Mr. Saltzman. And he works for Richard Berman. I mean, this isn't even a real think tank. This is a PR company.
Right, and it was picked up widely across the conservative media.
I know. The Associated Press picked it up, which was insane. This is nuts. So anyhow, find that piece and print it out for me tonight, would you? So I've got it on the desk in front of me because I want to inform David Selig about where he's getting his damn talking points from. Anyhow, it should be interesting. This is our first block. Our second block, what moms need to know about Obamacare, Block B.
Yeah, we're going to speak to Anya Benya. She is the senior policy analyst with the National Women's Law Center. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be talking about a lot of new things that are covered under Obamacare for moms that previously weren't. They include lactation counseling, well woman programs, even breastfeeding supplies, which can cost a lot of money as a lot of new parents know. So that's a great new coverage benefit of Obamacare. But this really comes on the heels of a new report. This says the U.S. ranks first in terrible treatment of new mothers. This was a report done by the U.N. and looked at developed nations across the world, and we were dead last, which is pretty amazing.
Terrible treatment. How do we define terrible treatment?
It's pretty awful.
Is it really? Okay.
Attorney practices at over 185 nations, and we were at the very bottom.
Yeah, okay. And then give dying patients a right to try life-saving experimental medicines. I'm really conflicted about this because I think that this is the drug industry's attempt to turn dying people into guinea pigs.
Yeah, this is definitely a big issue. There's a lot of possible nuances, so it should be an interesting conversation.
Okay, and then we're going to get into Koch Industries. Boy, we've got earthquake prediction. We've got a lot, and NPR in the media. We've got a lot coming up tonight. Thank you, Andrew. I'll see you tonight. Welcome back. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman program. Does not, however, lead to stiff thinking. Maybe I should call it, Ritalin for your brain is too weird. Caffeine for your brain, except caffeine is already, you know why I'm doing this right now? Because I already drank a half a cup of coffee. So and Jim is going, oh no. This is what happens when Tom has coffee. It's like, look out. Okay. Why should we go to charter schools, privatized schools? Let's make a buck off from schools. Why should we do this when Western Michigan University's Evaluation Center found that charter schools in Michigan posted significantly lower scores and less consistent gains on state standardized tests? This was in the year 2000, 2002 evaluation of charter schools in Pennsylvania. Quote, student achievement appears to be the source of modest strength for the schools. Modest. 2003 study of charter schools in Ohio found them falling short of traditional public schools on the majority of comparable performance measures. We're being sold a bill of goods. A 2010 study commissioned by the federal government conducted by Mathematica, found that students who won lotteries to attend 36 charter middle schools across the country performed on average no better in math or reading than their peers who lost out and had to enroll in nearby public schools. I mean, really? Charter schools produce no better outcome. The few who have statistics that they have better outcome are simply charter schools that are doing cherry picking. This is something that, you know, many of them in many states are allowed to do. What they do is they say, oh yeah, we'll take anybody. And then, you know, 4 weeks in, 10% of the student body has been kicked out because they're just, you know, hey, you're going to skew our test subjects or our test results. We can't have that. It's a terrible thing. Can't have that. By the way, is sugar a toxin? Experts debate the role of fructose in our obesity epidemic. This is interesting. Ralph Nader is going to be with us in our third hour. He's got a new book out there and a new idea that's pretty mind-blowing. And we're going to have, in our second hour, somebody from the 99 Rise organization, the March for Democracy. There's a lot of fascinating stuff going on in the country right now. And all over the place, in fact. Kevin in Santa Fe, listening on KTRC AM 1260, which was our first commercial affiliate way back like 10 years ago. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the program.
Well, welcome back to live. You've been here, not live, but we couldn't call in and talk to you and Bernie, although I have been listening. I remember you talking about sugar and the Inuit Indians, was it, getting cancer?
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting articles. It's just a joy to listen to information and have you back here in Santa Fe. I have a question. I wonder, do you ever ask a question of Bernie for someone?
Say what?
Ask a question of Bernie Sanders for me.
I can't make that commitment, Kevin, because my memory's just not that good. But I encourage you to call on Friday. In fact, you know, we open the phone lines at the top of the hour, and usually they're not full for the first 5 minutes or so. I probably shouldn't say that because now everybody will call in the first 5 minutes. But you can get in line pretty easily.
Oops. But anyway, my take on these schools would be that. I like the reporting. I think it was on Amy Goodman about how the federal government guarantees the loans made to these charter school companies. So it's really being pushed by the banksters because they get the money to lend out with federal guarantees. And it is sort of anti-public education, which I think is actually the best way to go.
Yeah, it's a giant scam. I mean, I wrote a book called Tom Hartman's Complete Guide to ADHD. Kevin, thanks for the call. And in that book, I lay out the history of education. And Neil was right. Horace Mann was pitching his stuff in the early 19th century, not the late 19th century. But here's what was going on, as I recall. But in the 1700s, in the late 1700s, the first public schools were started in Austria by Queen Maria Theresa or something. She was the monarch of Austria, and they were called Spinnenschulen, spinning schools, and the deal was that the kids would spend half the day spinning cloth, you know, turning cotton into or wool into fabric, or into thread, and making fabric, and then the other, and in exchange for that, instead of paying them, they would give them an education for the second half of the day. And this spread from Austria to Germany. But then at a certain point in time, and I'd have to go back, my quite solid recollection was that it was in the 1890s, but apparently, you know, Neil said the 1830s. He may well be. In any case, at some point in the 19th century, Germany invented this thing, the PhD, the PhD, a doctor of philosophy. And it was very fashionable to go over for Americans to go over to Germany, spend your $500, spend 6 months, and get your PhD, your PhD. And then come back and call yourself a doctor. And Horace Mann did this. And then he ran around the country pitching public schools as a way of creating conformity, creating good students to work in the factories, creating good soldiers for the military. Lots of things that you and I would not like and not agree with. But public education has, over the years, I mean, you can still say, yeah, okay, you know, you've got to raise your hand and ask, may I ask a question? I mean, there's all these things about public education that I frankly have a problem with, and I've written several books about how to reinvent public education. And Louise and I started a school in New Hampshire, which is still there, Hunter School, which we think is a nice example of different ways to do education. But there's this core concept that I think that we demonstrated at least in white schools in the middle of the peak of the middle class, of the white middle class in the United States in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And that is the public schools can work just fine. And in fact, when you look at the tragic fact that Neil pointed out in his article that black kids are performing less, they're not performing as well as white kids are in the United States. If you factor poverty out of that, which is purely a function of racial discrimination, if you factor out poverty, black kids and white kids do the same. It makes no difference.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So the net of this is that we have to figure out a new way to fund education in the United States so we have good schools, public schools, everywhere. By the way, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. And we're very pleased to have with us in the studio today Sue Nethercutt. Sue, who is normally in the United Kingdom. And pleased to have you with us. Thank you. I don't know if you want to wave at the camera. Do you want to come around and wave at the camera, Sue? You're welcome to. Have a seat and wave. Yeah, that's fine. And Jim, can you do that? Hang on just a minute. We want to put Sue on camera so that everybody can say hi. Sue flew in from the United Kingdom yesterday, and we wandered around the docks and had a nice meal. And yeah, walked your legs up. Okay, can't do that. Oh, you got to move this camera. Okay, all right. And Sue is normal. You know, in fact, Sue is in our chat room right now, but she's doing it from here. And Sue runs our chat rooms and puts together our newsletter every day and does all kinds of cool. There's Sue.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. Thank you for being here with us. Okay. So, and boom. Off she goes. Anyhow, did you see this thing about Farmers Insurance? Farmers Insurance is suing local governments for doing nothing about climate change. It's like they sued a couple hundred local governments. They said, hey, you guys, you knew that the storms were going to get worse, right? The atmosphere's got 5% more moisture in it. You knew that the flooding was going to be worse. You didn't improve your storm drains. You didn't build into the infrastructure. You didn't do any of this stuff. And we had to pay the claims on these people whose houses got drowned out because your damn storm drains weren't upgraded. We'd like our money back. Think about that for a minute. I think that's amazing. I think that's genuinely amazing. Bill in Netherland, Colorado. Bill, you wanted to talk about schools, the public schools?
Yeah, hi, Tom. It's great to talk to you. I've been listening for many years, and I just lost you on AM 760. It's a real it's a big change in my quality of life. But anyway, I've been a school bus driver up here in Netherland, Colorado, for 30 years, and for a long time, I drove a whole lot of athletic trips all over the state of Colorado and, went to a lot of private and religious schools. And the difference in the facilities at the private and charter schools and religious schools is just incredible. You know, I would pull up in my 15-year-old bus and park next to, you know, their brand new shiny vehicles and, you know, they have incredible gyms and everything. And it's really been, I think there's been a real drain away from the public education system where I came from and where I know that you came from. And
yep.
I think it's a really unfortunate thing. We're fairly lucky in here in the Boulder Valley School District. We've gotten fairly good support from our taxpayers with bond issues and things. But over the decades that I've been doing this, I've really seen the, our facilities decline while the private and charter schools seem to be sucking up a lot of the money.
You know, I was watching Cosmos I think it was. You know, the new show with Neil deGrasse Tyson, the new version of it, Carl Sagan's old show. And it's on Showtime now, I think. And Louise and I were watching the early segments over the weekend because we hadn't seen it live, and there's been a lot of buzz about it. And he was talking about, you know, we left footprints on the moon. And it just suddenly hit me as he was talking about footprints on the moon that there was a time in America when we were putting people on the moon. And right now, you know, we can't even maintain the space shuttle program. I mean, we can't get the International Space Station is run by the Russians now. We're turning to them for flight, and we've tried to privatize rockets. It's not so working out so well. And the same thing with our schools. It's like, basically, since Ronald Reagan became president, we have not put a penny into anything. We are no longer, you know, this great shining city on the hill as we were before his presidency. And we haven't built, and, you know, I mean, we've probably built some new schools, but basically, you know, we haven't been upgrading public education or even maintaining it. So the schools, you know, are probably on average 30, 40, 50 years old or older. And so, you know, yeah, if somebody builds a new charter school or a new private school, especially if they're doing it with public money, then it looks spiffier and everybody goes, oh, isn't that cool? But it's not just our schools. I mean, it's mind boggling to me. It's the damage that Reaganomics has done to America. Bill, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for sticking with us. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida, listening on Progressive Voices on TuneIn Radio. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hey, Charles.
I was just listening to you. I guess it was your first guest.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I strongly disagree with any of these topics and any of these ideas that people have about taking money away from the federal education system. Mm. To be honest with you, it's done its job from its inception, but so many people have tried to change it. And you could, I guess, go back to Brown versus the Board of Education.
Yeah.
And to me, you know, basically they're trying to weaken the federal government's grip, and they want to take this money and use it for their own purposes, but it's not benefiting us as a whole. To me, I'm worried about kids that's homeschooled. I'm pretty sure, you know, parents do have a reason to want to homeschool their kids, but as a member, as someone who's been through the public school system, I was engaged with so many different ethnicities, different cultures, meeting different people. You get to, you know, build up your ideas of how to interact with people.
Yeah.
You know, and you get to find out what you agree with and what you disagree with. And to be honest with you, I think that's a problem as a whole in our society now. So many people can't relate to each other. And I think, you know, once we opened up the school system and we desegregated it,
right,
you know, that helped America progress. And it's never going to go back to how it was before. It's, you know, so to anyone who wants to bring America back to those days are long gone.
Yeah.
But as far as taking money from the federal government, just like charter schools, I heard de Blasio, he was in a big fight. I don't know how it ended up in New York.
It hasn't ended up yet. But he's basically saying, enough already. We are giving too much public money to these private schools, particularly the for-profit private schools, and we need to dial this back. And he's getting furious pushback. I mean, furious pushback. Because you've got everybody from the Bill Gates Foundation on, you know, you got billionaires funding the idea of these private schools. When in fact, if we simply made our public schools work, and we know how to do that, there are public schools all over America that are working just fine, thank you very much. They just happen to be in neighborhoods where there's funding. There's two issues here, Charles, when it comes to education, and they're really just fundamental bedrock principles. The first is you want to fund a school appropriately. You pay your teachers well. You have a facility that works. You have to have a tax base. You have to figure out a way to pay for that. But even more importantly, when you look at educational outcomes, and this is, you know, the tragedy of the whole Charles Murray stuff, the bell curve stuff, this guy that Paul Ryan was quoting the other day. When you look at the outcomes, regardless of the quality of the schools, there is a disparity in outcomes that appears to be racial on its surface. But when you dig underneath it and you simply look at economics, you find that it's actually an economic disparity. And you can track this in West Virginia among white people as easily as you can comparing black people and white people in a major city where the black people are poorer than the white people as a result of generations of discrimination and redlining and all that other stuff that has prevented black communities from accumulating the wealth, the actual capital wealth and the social wealth that white families have. And so we need to do two things. We need to rebuild our schools, number one, and actually number two. But number one, we need to end poverty in this country. We're the richest country in the world. It's insane that we have people living in poverty.
The thing is, I agree with you 100%. And I think one of the first things we need to do is get corporate America out of our education system.
Yeah.
Because that sets up the greed.
Yeah.
And any way that they can, they can fund the federal government. People are going
to
do it.
Yeah, there is no good reason for us not to have a world class school system, and there is no good reason for us to have poverty in this country. Charles, thank you for the call. Ron in Lake Manchi, California. Hey, Ron.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good. So you say there's a reason why we can't fund anything. Why is that?
Well, actually, this is ancient. This is the warnings from all the history, if you ask me, just a logical person, Thomas Paine type of common sense thing. You look at history, you look at all the world's police, and all the great nations, and they became a shell of themselves simply because they overextended their expenditures. They choked themselves off.
Saying we need to stop being empire.
Well, with $1 trillion a year, what a waste. A year ago, the Pentagon came out and said that they mistakenly lost $2 trillion.
Right.
I don't know about you, but I would like to fund all of the high school seniors with that money to make a world-class education here in America so that we lead the world in great thinkers.
The amount of money that we spend every year in subsidies to the fossil fuel industry and support for the fossil fuel industry is greater than the amount of money it would take to give every college student in America a free education. And that you'd have money left over that we could deal with high schools. I'm with you, Ron. We need to stop being the world's policeman. Thank you for the call. We will be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So how do we do that? You know, Lyndon Johnson actually cut poverty in half in about 5 years in this country. And then we went about taking apart his program. And welcome back. Ed in Belfair, Washington, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite network. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Well, I was calling about the private schools, and my three things on that is they're not union, so the teachers that they are getting there are probably surviving on just the wages that they're getting, mm-hmm. which are probably lower than teachers in our regular high schools.
Yeah.
And I don't think they're motivated because they probably don't have health care or retirement or anything, and so it's just a stopover area for them to get it, to keep their teaching degree until they get to public schools,
right.
because they know they're going to be able to survive. And I think the public schools are great. I've been to the teachers and talked to them for my niece, and every one of them are great.
Yeah, nobody goes into teaching for the money.
No.
Unless it's an administrator in a for-profit school, and that's the tragedy.
And they're sucking up all the money.
Yep.
But my thing about private schools, too, are they're selective about their teaching. So they're probably not teaching. Some of them aren't teaching good science. Some of them aren't teaching good history,
yep.
mathematics. I mean, and especially the religious sector part of it.
Yeah.
I'm so totally against that. I don't know why any public funding should be going to any private school. That doesn't make any sense to me. If they can't make it on their own, then they don't make it.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. Excellent point. Corky in Hilton, New York, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Corky, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
Yeah, you just were talking about that $2 trillion that's missing.
Well, the caller mentioned it, but yeah, it's out there. It's the last attempt to audit the Pentagon came up $2 trillion short. It was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, you mentioned Carl Sagan. Well, I'm a Carl Sagan fanatic. What he used was he extrapolated. He took the things we know,
mm-hmm.
and then he extrapolated it out with his imagination to the things that were possible.
Yeah.
Now, if you take is still technology that we know. And you extrapolate that out. That could be put to spacecraft. We're going to the moon or to space every week. But we have stealth technology. Nobody.
Well, we're putting spy satellites up. I'll give you that.
Well, why can't we put a spacecraft up there with people in it?
Because there's no because you would have to roll back the Reagan tax cuts on the billionaires. I mean, you can either have the Koch brothers be worth $80 billion and the Walton family be worth $140 billion, or you can send men to the moon. You can't do both.
No, I know, and that's what we're doing. We're sending the men to the moon. We're not doing both.
No, no.
When you have money missing like that,
yeah.
Where does it go?
I don't know. We sent an amount of cash to Iraq on pallets, $100 bills wrapped in plastic on pallets, big enough to be seen from outer space. You could see this stuff on Google Earth or something. I mean, you know, there's actually, you know, satellite photos of these pallets of cash, and now the Pentagon can't account for almost any of it. It's like it just vanished, you know, and it was literally, I think it was $6 billion. It's just, it's mind-boggling. We really need to get our military, Corky, thanks for the call. We really need to get our military under control. We really need to say, you know, we don't need to be the world's police. We don't need to be an empire. England stopped being an empire after World War I. They basically lost their empire status. It has been really good for them. We'll be back. So Sue actually saw it. She was on our boat yesterday, and the stern cleat that ties the line to the pole next to the boat is in a little box, and you can pop open the door on that box inside the boat and see where the rope goes outside the boat, and a so-called pigeon has put a nest in there and has two so-called eggs, but they've been there for a month, and pigeon eggs hatch in 2 weeks. So we're pretty sure what's going on. This is a cleverly painted dove with a couple of egg-shaped monitoring devices. They are spying on us. There's no doubt about it. And, you know, it's not just me saying it. Sue actually saw it. You can talk to her in the chat room. She'll tell you all about it. Audrey in Richton Park, Illinois. Hey, Audrey, what's on your mind?
Hi. I was calling to talk about the situation with our nation's schools, public,
and
Catholic. Really, it seems like we're all under, working class period is under attack, this war on the poor as opposed to the war against poverty.
Yeah.
The best way to attack the working class is to cheapen them, to cheapen us.
To break them, you know, to take away their money. I mean, to impoverish them.
Right, and yeah. So the thing is, if you look at it, there have been Catholic schools closing too recently because there aren't enough working class families right now to keep a lot of those schools open.
Yeah.
But it seems like even the public schools, of course, you know, that was definitely a way that was easier to attack us. There is a book out called Focus. It was distributed to us when we tried to volunteer. I tried to volunteer at a mentoring program, a national mentoring program at a local high school.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the schedule to allow me to really participate, but he pointed out something very interesting, that often in public schools, in predominantly African-American and Hispanic neighborhoods, the prison industry, these privately owned business entities that manage and operate federal and perhaps in local and state prisons, you know that they use that sometimes the inmates in some of those prisons are used to manufacture items sold at retail nowadays.
Yes.
They're paid like 25, 50 cents per hour.
Yeah, I think this is almost entirely a state prison phenomenon. But yes, we've done programs on this. I'm right there with you.
Right. Right. And so this book pointed out that what some of these prisons, privately owned prison industry and business entities will do is they will use the statistics from these predominantly black and brown public schools to to determine how many prisons they should build in the future.
No,
particularly, the number of students with failing grades in the fourth grade.
Yeah.
It's almost as if they're suggesting that us African-American women, you know, we carry these kids for 9 months, then, you know, we go through hours of labor and delivery, all the sacrifice and effort and love and training that we give them, and we're supposed to give up on our kids to a prison industry that doesn't give a rat's patootie about them if they're failing before they're 10 years old.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this again, gets back to, obviously, you know, back to the redlining issues, the systematic racism, but beyond that, the issue of poverty in the United States. The issue of equality in the United States, the issue of, you know, the average black family has a net wealth of around $5,000. The average white family in America has an average wealth of around $80,000. These are fundamental structural things that are built into our system that are wrong and that need to be changed and can be changed. And LBJ went a ways in changing them. And then Reagan came along and said, "No, we're going to undo this." And then Clinton even, you know, undid them even farther with ending welfare as we know it. Now, it's not to say everything was working perfectly or even close to perfectly, but you don't throw away a program. And now we're really suffering as a consequence of that, because many of these social safety net programs, now that we've got a long-term crisis in capitalism, as a result in part of the deregulation of the banksters, Phil Gramm and you know, his wife Wendy being on the board of Enron and all that, Phil Gramm with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act and Gramm-Leach Bliley, and partly because of our insane trade policies and a few other variables, and the Reagan tax cuts. I mean, you know, it's making billionaires and raising taxes on working people. All of this stuff together has eviscerated our middle class and has exaggerated the differences in income in A, between communities of color and white communities, but B, even in communities that are, you know, all the same race, between middle class communities and working class communities. Because the working class, I mean, 40 years ago, the number one employer in the United States was GM, and they paid $50 an hour in today's dollars. Today, the largest employer in the United States is Walmart, and they pay $10 an hour in today's wages. And so whether you're looking at West Virginia or whether you're looking at Detroit, it doesn't, you know, the issues at the end of the day become economic, and we really need to be dealing with these. And you're so right that we have created this perverse incentive, this private prison industry, where we're saying, yes, you can make a buck off these people. And these guys, and they're the ones who are lobbying for the more rigorous drug laws, and they're the ones who are lobbying to, in some cases, actually keep money out of the public schools. I think it's just a crime. Audrey, thank you for the call. Regina in Shorewood, Illinois. Regina, we just have a minute to the end of the hour here. It's yours.
Okay, thank you. I do homeschool my daughter, but we are very progressive. The school just doesn't fit for all kids. And as the gentleman said, you know, in public school, he feels that you're able to get more diversity. But where we live, that's not the case. This is a middle upper class area where everybody's white. And pretty wealthy, and you're sitting with 30 kids exactly the same age as you, exactly like you, in a room. Yeah. Well, homeschooling allows us to take her out into the world and to work with people of all ages and go more in-depth in things that she learns. It's difficult not finding, you know, evangelical groups, I guess, to be parts of. But for us, it allows more because she does not learn the way that they teach in the school.
No, I understand and agree, Regina. Our youngest child, we homeschooled the last 4 or 5 years of her education for many of the same reasons. It wasn't that there was anything wrong with the public schools. I mean, we were living in Montpelier, Vermont, for goodness sake, so they've got very good schools. But she wanted to learn at her own rate, and I think she came out much the better for it. But there's still I'm still a huge supporter of public schools. Regina, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you in the second hour of our program, 6 minutes past the hour. I was laying in bed this morning listening to our local NPR station because I can't get our local progressive station, and I found myself screaming at the radio. I just have to say this. NPR and everyone else, by the way, because they're not the only ones who are pitching this line, please stop lying to us. Please stop reading corporate press releases to us and calling them news. Let me lay this out for you. This morning, NPR took a stab at covering the proposed merger of AT&T and DirecTV that was officially announced over the weekend on Sunday. Listen to this.
If you've streamed a movie or a TV show recently, you are part of the problem facing cable and satellite providers. These companies are facing more and more competition from internet streaming, and to survive, some are consolidating. Yesterday, AT&T announced that it is buying the satellite TV provider DirecTV. The deal, which still needs to be approved by government regulators, would be worth nearly $50 billion.
NPR is completely wrong. This has nothing to do with AT&T or DirecTV surviving. They're both big, profitable companies, and if the industry is changing, they can change to adapt to it, which, by the way, both companies are already doing. What this is really about is monopoly. Just like the Comcast-Time Warner merger, just like Sprint's plans to try to take over T-Mobile, and Sprint's not even an American company, this AT&T DirecTV move is all about monopoly. And it's, by the way, it's not limited to the telco industry. It's just they're the most recent because, you know, the internet is more recent than wheat. These mergers and acquisitions are about corporations getting so large that they dominate an industry and limit your choices to a very, very small number of companies, which then all suddenly start raising their prices and increasing their profits. What this is about, NPR, is screwing the customer. And it's all because back in 1982, Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. It's amazing how things have changed since then. I mean, back in the 70s, Richard Nixon saw that AT&T's monopoly on telephone service was stifling innovation and jacking up prices to consumers and crushing competition. So he initiated a breakup of AT&T that ended during the Carter administration, broke AT&T into 7 regional carriers. They were known as the Baby Bells, and spun off their R&D arm. They called it Lucent Technologies. That was Carter in the 70s, right? Finishing what Nixon started in the early 70s. And then came Reagan in the 80s, and the Baby Bells began to reconsolidate. And so did everybody else in the industry. And now we are all paying twice, 3 times, sometimes 10 times what people in countries that actually enforce antitrust laws, countries like Germany and France, we pay so much more than they pay for internet, for cell phone, for cable TV. If the media had any interest at all in telling the true story, they'd say, AT&T is trying to further cement their control over the choices you have for telephone and internet service and grab a part of your choices about TV by buying DirecTV. If they're successful, expect your prices to go up while your choices go down, just as has happened pretty much every other time any industry has succumbed to this sort of monopolistic behavior. End of quote. Not that I want to do your work for you, NPR, but really. Do you really mean this? But they're not going to tell you that because they're nearly all monopolies themselves. NPR has a lock on and a government subsidy for radio stations all across the country. The big TV networks and the big cable companies won't tell you what's really going on with AT&T because more and more of a monopoly, you know, with them, AT&T becoming more of a monopoly because they're all playing the same game themselves. And it's not just telecom and media companies that are growing into virtual monopolies. I mean, right now, there are 10 giant corporations that control, either directly or indirectly, virtually every consumer product you buy. These companies are Kraft, Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Nestle, Procter & Gamble, General Mills, Kellogg's, Mars, Unilever, and Johnson & Johnson. 90%. They got a complete stranglehold on the American consumer goods market. In the retail industry, Walmart, Target, Home Depot, Best Buys, they control a major portion of America's retail industry. You can basically pick any industry in America and see the monopolistic characteristics of it. And that's why we should pass a new version of the Sherman Antitrust Act that says explicitly, and by the way, the original version of the Sherman Act is still on the books, and it says if you break this law, you go to prison. Been a long time since anybody did that. Anyhow, it says that we need a new version of it that says explicitly that whenever a company reaches a point where they have more than a certain percentage of a marketplace, say 10 or 15%, that they just can't grow any larger in that domain. They have to leave room for startups, for innovators, and for competitors. There was a time in America when nearly every business on Main Street or in your local strip mall, was locally owned by local families. They paid well. They took care of their employees. They had great customer service. If you're old enough to remember America before Reagan, you know what I'm talking about. The antitrust laws kept the big boys at bay for over a century, from the 1880s to the 1980s. There was even a TV show that ran in from 1960 to 1964. It was called Route 66. Marty Milner and George Maharis driving from town to town as they went from coast to coast on Route 66. Every town was different. Every restaurant and hotel was unique. And those differences from place to place provided an unending series of interesting plots for that TV series. America back then worked because we enforced the antitrust laws. It's time to start doing that again and even expand those antitrust laws and add some teeth to them. No more too big to fail banks or retail stores or fast food franchises or media companies or internet companies. Let's get back to some core American values. Let's rebuild our nation's small business sector, because until we do, you're not going to see innovation and competition in America. I mean, look at the pharmaceutical companies, for example. We're down to, like, I think it's a big six, and half of them aren't even American, you know, headquartered companies. And now you've got one of them, what is it, Pfizer, trying to buy AstraZeneca so that they can move their headquarters out of the United States so that they can stop paying U.S. taxes, even though they want to use an American-educated workforce, they want to use the American infrastructure, they want the American court system to enforce their patents. They want, you know, they're all about having us help them be successful in business, but pay taxes? No. And so you got this handful of drug companies that can buy people like Billy Towson to propose legislation like Medicare Part D that says explicitly that, yeah, the government can give pharmaceuticals to people who are on Medicare, but they can't negotiate price. You got to pay full retail. You can't do like the VA does and say, you know, we need a million this year. We're going to need a million penicillin pills. And instead of asking Pfizer or whoever, you know, what's your price on one penicillin pill at retail at the pharmacy, which is what Medicare has to do, they say, you know, if we wanted to buy a million pills, what kind of discount are you going to give us? Oh, instead of selling for $3 at retail, you can sell it to us for 20 cents at wholesale? Cool, we'll take it. We are getting screwed 16 ways to Sunday on everything from drugs to food to the internet. because we're not, because Reagan stopped enforcing our the Sherman Antitrust Act, leading to the mergers and acquisitions mania of the early 80s, leading to Mitt Romney.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And Mitt Romney's buddies, these private equity guys who make out like bandits, sending our jobs overseas and stripping our companies. It's amazing. It's just amazing. And now they want to do this to our schools, right? And our prisons. Hey, let's create, you've got two giant for-profit prison companies. You got five or six fairly large for-profit school companies. You got a couple of large for-profit colleges. I mean, it's just, it is, all hail the corporate chiefs, right? We don't have kings in the United States. I mean, Sue just came over and visited from the United Kingdom. They're, at least their royalty is up front about who they are. Yes, we are supported by the taxpayers, and there's no legitimate reason for us to exist other than that the country would like some pomp and ceremony, and it's appropriate to have a head of state. Not a head of government, but a head of state. And I can actually see that, right? I wouldn't mind, you know, if I was British, I'd keep the royal family. And let the Queen, you know, do ribbon cuttings and things. It doesn't cost that much. But here in the United States, we've got a new royalty. And it's the corporate, and I'm going off on a rant here. Let me get some calls in here. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Okay. Actually, you kind of veered into what I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
And that is, we actually went through a budget process in Prince William County, and I'm looking around here and I'm saying, well, the schools need money, but why are the schools building buildings and driving buses and doing things that really don't have anything to do with schools? In other words, the Park Authority.
Well, wait a second. You don't have school employees building buildings. You hire private contractors to build buildings, don't you?
Well, yeah, I know. I'm well aware of the low bidder concept. I've built about four schools, but in a courthouse. But that's okay. But the point is that we have so many duplicative, repetitive bureaucracies built in to this system, that if we were to simply specialize them, put them under direct control of, let's say, the actual school part needs to go into the control of the parents. And there are some things that private schools do better, and there are some things that public schools do better.
What do private schools do better?
What's that?
What is, you know, let me just be on the record. I agree with you that the parents should be ultimately responsible, and the way they are ultimately responsible is by running for the school board. And the school board and the PTA should be running the schools.
All right, we agree on that one.
And the school board and the PTA are both elected bodies. You know, one has
right.
actual financial power, the other has influence, shall we say. And, you know, that's all good. The problem is if you have a really poor neighborhood, they really need some cash. I mean, you know, no matter how much the parents are running it, they're not going to be able to pay the bills. But
all right.
What is it that private schools do better than public schools?
All right. Let me give you a solution that is relevant, and that is now my train derailed
okay.
in my
but
head.
But if you can just come up with one thing that a private school does better than a public school, other than make money.
Weapons training.
Weapons training?
Yeah. We used to have 350 kids. We used to drill with M1 rifles and train on.
Oh, you're talking about private military academies?
Yeah.
We have public military academies. I mean, you just have to wait to go to college to do it. But, you know, they used to have ROTC at MSU. I'm assuming they still do. And you've got West Point. I mean, you know, if you can get in. Steve, you haven't convinced me. Good try, though. Call again. Thanks a lot for the call. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us, marchfordemocracy.org and 99rise.org, we have with us Kai Newkirk and Danielle Raskin. Am I saying that right?
That's right.
Great.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. I'm assuming you're Kai and not Danielle.
That's right.
Okay. Is Danielle on the line, too?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, great, great. So tell me, what is March for Democracy? What is 99 Rise?
Nonviolent Rise is a grassroots progressive organization that's fighting to end corruption and win real democracy, and we're using nonviolent civil resistance to do that. And the California March for Democracy is the campaign that we've just started. And our vision with this is that we needed to do something to inspire all the people around the country who know, like I'm sure many of your listeners do, that our democracy is corrupted. We're not living in a democracy anymore. It's a plutocracy. The wealthy are really running our country in their interests. But a lot of people don't feel like there's anything that we can do about it or that we can win change. And so we wanted to do something that was bold and was going to show the kind of sacrifice and the urgency that we need to win change on this. So we're marching 480 miles, Tom, from L.A. all the way to Sacramento to demand that the leaders of our state, the biggest state in the union, take leadership on this, that they acknowledge the crisis of corruption and take immediate action to end it.
Right. And to take immediate action to end that corruption, Danielle, they should do what?
So we're calling on California legislators to take three steps. The first step we want them to take is to call for an Article 5 resolution, which basically calls for a constitutional convention with the specific purpose of adding an amendment to get money out of politics. And that's already passed through the Assembly. The second thing we want them to do is SB 1272, which is a voter instruction measure, which would allow California voters to vote on whether they think we should overturn Citizens United and get money out of politics. The third is the Disclose Act, which would require California politicians to have to disclose who they're accepting their donations from, mm-hmm. and would allow us to sort of see where this corruption is coming from and who is actually influencing our politicians and the work that they do and accepting donations.
So you're trying to do it at a state level, what we really need to do at a federal level. And ironically, in Citizens United, where they said, yeah, anybody can buy a politician, they actually, in the majority opinion, suggested that federal legislatures pass laws demanding transparency, but that we just somehow never got around to that. So basically, that's what you're asking for, or part of it. Do I have that right?
That's right. That's right. That's one of the key steps. And I think that it's telling, you know, that the Supreme Court said, yeah, it's not going to be corruption. You can do disclosure. But the Disclose Act at the federal level didn't move, and we're having a tough time here in California because that's just going to expose the corruption more and put politicians in a tough spot where folks are going to see this very clearly. And the Disclose Act, what the big step that it would take is it would expose the secret money that's coming in. As you know, Tom, a lot of this unlimited money that's been unleashed by Citizens United is undisclosed. It's dark money. The donors are anonymous.
Right.
And in California, especially because with the ballot initiative, big money plays such a huge role.
Oh, you saw this big time in the ballot initiative to label organic foods. And you saw it in Initiative 5, the one to amend the Constitution, outlaw gay marriage, where it turned out that it was the Mormon Church that had dumped all kinds of money into it?
Absolutely. And if people knew who the big donors were that were behind those campaigns, which are often named very innocuously, and the it would make a difference, and people would at least be able to see more clearly where the interest behind that. And it would also show people how much this money is coming in. So the top three donors would have to be made visible very prominently in any ad that they finance.
We're talking to Kai Newkirk and Danielle Raskin, activists and marchers for 99 Rise and marchfordemocracy.org, 99rise.org. Danielle, has this become in California a partisan issue? What I find is, for example, the amendment proposed by MoveToAmend.org, you know, basically says money isn't speech and corporations aren't people, has been introduced into the U.S. House of Representatives by four Democrats. There, to the best of my knowledge, there's not a single Republican who's signed on to it. Is there a similarly partisan nature to this in California?
Well, you see, if you look at national polls and you see that the issue of money in politics is actually, there's tripartisan agreement on it. So somewhere between 70-90% of Americans, regardless of what party you identify with, all agree that we need to reduce the influence of money in politics. So I would say that it's not a partisan issue.
The Democrats have been stronger on it. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt in California, but there is some Republican support.
That's great. Because, I mean, the Republicans, Kai, are in the minority in the California legislature. And And so you would think, given that the Democrats are in the majority, that the Republicans might be in favor of some disclosure that might embarrass the Democrats, unless, you know, the Republicans only exist because of dark money. I don't know. It's like.
That's right. They're very concerned about it, too. They want to have that advantage. There is generally more big money, and especially anonymous dark money that's going into Republicans. But it's definitely a problem for Democrats, too.
Yeah.
And we think that if we can get the leaders of this state, the biggest state in the union, eighth biggest economy in the country, right, to respond to this issue and to take action, that it's going to give hope to people around the country. And so we started out, we had a great rally kickoff at L.A. City Hall. We've been marching. We're on day three, about to head over the mountains. And we are confident that when we go into Sacramento, we're going to have a lot of people supporting us and bring this simple demand to our leaders. And if they haven't met that demand to acknowledge corruption, that it's a crisis, and to take immediate action to end it, then we're going to do an occupation of the Capitol nonviolently to press this issue further.
Remarkable. Kai Newkirk and Danielle Raskin, actual activists out there doing the work. The websites are 99rise.org and marchfordemocracy.org. Danielle, Kai, thank you for being with us today.
Great to be with you, Tom. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good talking with you both. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, marching for democracy is great. Calling for democracy is great. Get out there and do something, eh? Good, the bad, and the very, very piperously ugly. The good. Portland, Oregon. On Thursday, my former hometown took a, well, I'm not sure, hometown? I lived there for 5 years. That's close enough. Anyhow, it took a big step toward a more responsible financial future when it divested 25% or $9 million worth of the Walmart bonds that it currently owns. The move was part of a plan to totally erase Portland's $36 million Walmart investment portfolio by 2016. The city now plans to put the $9 million it divested on Thursday into more sustainable and socially responsible investments. Let's hope more towns and cities around the country start following Portland's lead. The bad. Gary Kehenny. Kehenny. Yeah, it's got to be. Say what? Kane, you think? Okay, we'll have to look it up. Anyhow, during Saturday's Republican primary debate, the Arizona congressional candidate claimed that Democrats are responsible for all of America's recent mass shootings. I'm not making this up. Take a listen.
If you look at all of the fiascos that have occurred, 99% of them have been by Democrats pulling their guns out and shooting people. So I don't think you have a problem with the Republicans.
Yeah, I'm not sure where Gary is getting his statistics. But I do, though, that 99%, maybe even all, of the mass shootings in recent history could have been prevented if Republicans had stopped shilling for the NRA and helped pass meaningful gun control laws. And the very, very ugly, Pamela Geller, the conservative activist and professional Islamophobe, has just started up her newest anti-Muslim campaign, and as usual, it's totally over the top. Check it out.
The face of Hitler on Metro buses, part of a controversial ad campaign hitting the streets this week. The ad will appear on the sides of 20 buses calling for an end to U.S. foreign aid to Islamic countries. The picture of Hitler shows him meeting with an anti-Jewish Islamic leader during World War II. Pamela Geller heads the group who bought the ads.
My intent is to leapfrog over a media that is not even-handed, that is advancing the propaganda against the Jewish state.
That's right. Pamela Geller's new ads compare Islam to Hitler. I think it's safe to say at this point that anything involving Geller and her so-called activism is just very, very ugly. That's mind-boggling. That's really sad. Joe in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today? Joe? We got Joe's got a phone call. Don in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Don, what's up?
Well, not much, Tom. Glad to talk to you. I love your ranting because that's what makes you the great writer you are.
Oh, well, thank you.
You're welcome. But then I hope Danielle and Kai both get those people that they're promoting to fight the millionaires, get the lower class to be out there voting.
Yeah, I'm with you. Get working people out there voting, you mean. Yeah, it says here you're a retired teacher. You wanted to talk about charter schools?
Yeah, well, I did. The funny part is that I was thinking about the – I never heard the Democrats complain about paying taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans, they all are overcharged. And, of course, you know, the Koch brothers, they're paying for my pension now because I never paid anything into it that I remember. And they're paying for my health care because I'm retired. And, of course, Obama's given all of us something to keep us voting for him. It's just a wonderful world out there.
So that's interesting. The Koch brothers are paying for your pension. You're a retired teacher. Are you being facetious, Don?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I figured.
I really am.
Your humor is just dry enough that you had me baffled there for
a
moment. Okay. Yeah. I got it. Don, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to us there in St. Paul, Joe. In near Chicago, Illinois, you wanted to disagree with me?
Yeah, I don't think the school thing is just a matter of money.
No, it's not.
You can throw as much money as you want at a school, but if you don't have parents at home that are working with their kids to better themselves, because, I mean, I grew up in a poor family, and all I had was my mother, no father, and my sister. And we didn't have a lot of money, but what I got from her was a work ethic to work hard and make myself better.
Right. And what you're describing, Joe, is much more likely to happen in communities that have good associations with, or in families, rather, that have good associations with or come from or have relatives in the American middle class. And I agree with you. Throwing money at schools does not solve the problem. The biggest problem that we find in our educational system in the United States is the poverty from which the children come. Children who come from poor families, regardless of race, regardless of region, will do, regardless of quality of the school, frankly, generally speaking, will do less well than children who come from middle class and upper class families. And so our goal should be to end poverty in the United States. And while we're at it, it wouldn't be a bad idea to fix enough of our schools that they all can, you know, once again have a decent gym and a decent science lab and maybe even offer music instruction.
I don't think just ending poverty is going to do it. I mean, you can give somebody as much money as they need to be able to survive, but if you're just giving them money and the kids are seeing that the parents aren't working for their money, then they're going to take that same look at it. They're going to do the same thing.
Joe, I don't, you know, if your concern is the you know, roughly 1-2% of people who actually will take the government dole and sit around on their butts, even though they're able-bodied, I don't disagree with you. I think, though, that it's irrelevant. It's such a small percentage of people. There are lots and lots of people in the United States right now who are unemployed, and the Republicans are refusing to extend their unemployment benefits on the theory that this is some kind of hammock. That's nonsense. People want to work. This is what Franklin Roosevelt proved to us when he said the government is going to be the employer of last resort. Would you like a job? And people showed up in droves for those CCC and WPA jobs, even though it was hard, demanding work, and it didn't pay all that well, frankly. People showed up in droves. The best welfare program in the world is a job, and we should go back and look at FDR's second Bill of Rights, in which he suggested that we should actually amend the Constitution to say that education is a right and that a decent-paying job is a right, and that if capitalism fails, as it had done in the early 1930s, and as it is doing right now, by the way, if capitalism fails to provide a decent job to everybody, the government will step in and be the employer of last resort until capitalism gets its act back together again, as it eventually did back in the 1950s in the United States. I'm I understand where you're coming from, but you have to understand the larger dynamic. This is not about lazy parents. It's about poor parents who can't get jobs. There are places in West Virginia, in Kentucky, actually in every state in the United States, regardless of race, where people can simply not find work, where there used to be work and there isn't work. The jobs are now in China and Vietnam, and they're not here. And as a consequence, those kids, children of poverty, I mean, in some cases, they don't even have enough to eat. Children of poverty don't do as well in school. We need to address poverty. Al in Sierra Vista, Arizona. Hey, Al, what's on your mind?
Oh, how are you today, sir?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you, Al?
I'm always good. I was calling to get your opinion. In talking about schools and talking about financing, et cetera, what happened to all of the money that the states were raising when they were promoting state lotteries? Where did that money go to, and why is it not being put towards better education?
What has happened, Al, is over the last 33 years in the United States, since Reagan defined the government as the problem, not greedy or predatory corporations or corruption or rich people who are corrupting the system for their own benefit, which everybody pretty much knew before the 80s, but now everybody thinks government is the problem. Ever since then, we have been steadily cutting back on our tax base. On top of that, we have an economy that's for at least the last decade is being held together with baling wire and string. The average wages of working people since 2000 have gone down by $5,000 a year, the average wage of working people in the United States. Now, when the average wages of working people go down, then your tax base, the ability of people to pay property taxes goes down. When you have massive loss of housing, as we've had in the United States, millions of people losing their home because the banks scammed them, you lose your tax base. And property taxes fund a lot of our schools. So what has happened is that the money from those lotteries is about the last thing that's keeping the schools open. Whereas originally the plan was, let's use the lottery money so we can strengthen our schools, we can expand our schools. But, Reaganomics has hollowed out the middle class, it's destroying working class people, and thus it's destroying the tax base, the property tax base, for our schools. You can't run schools just on the fact that you've got one rich guy in the neighborhood who pays a lot of property taxes. It doesn't work. You've got to distribute it over a large base, and that means that you've got to have people who, A, own their homes rather than are on the verge of foreclosure, and B, who have a decent enough income that they can afford to pay property taxes. So that's what's happened, Al, in a nutshell. Thanks a lot for the call. Excellent question, by the way, because it takes us back to that era 30 years ago where we started saying, our schools are doing pretty good. How can we make them do better? And now we're asking questions like, our schools aren't doing all that well. How can we figure out how somebody can make a buck off them?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Which is just wrong. Nobody should be making a buck off our schools. Nobody should be making a buck off our prisons. This is the commons. Welcome back. Catherine in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Catherine, what's on your mind?
Hi. Well, I have some information about how to get more information about what's going on with the schools and an idea of how to turn it into activism.
Okay.
Yes Magazine at yesmagazine.org. Current issue is about education uprising.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a really great chart in there that says how corporations created the education crisis.
Right.
And why corporations want our public schools. It's also showing you at the grassroots what individual schools are doing to fight back along with their students. Now, the way we can, and also the Progressive Magazine will be collaborating with them on this education issue. This is how important they see it.
Mm-hmm.
So what you can do is this. If you have $15, you can buy 5 copies of the magazine and give it out. If you don't have $15 to buy 5 copies, because they give it to you for $3 when you buy 5, see if you can get 1 copy. Get your library to subscribe to it and make sure they have that copy. Show it to your friends, and then ask them to show it to other people. If you have an iPad or an iPhone, pull up, and you have a connection, Wi-Fi connection, pull up this copy and show it to them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we each tell 5 other people about how this has happened, then we're going to have a much bigger coalition. And never assume that someone already knows, the teacher in the classroom. I mean, bring it to your mayor. Bring it to your city council. And one of the reasons that's important is because ALEC is now going after the elimination or control of school boards and city councils.
Yep. I'm absolutely with you. I'm totally in support of Yes Magazine. In fact, this fall I will be in Seattle keynoting a conference put on by Yes Magazine. It's published by Fran Corton, David Corton's wife, who is a dear friend, both of them. I've stayed in their home. They're just wonderful people. And I haven't seen this story. I'm going to have to look it up. Thank you for the heads up on that, and maybe we can even get the author of it on the program. That's great information to have. Catherine, thanks so much for the call. Great to hear from you. Ed, in Klamath Falls, Oregon, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. What's up, Ed?
I've been watching the controversy about raising the minimum wage up because of fast food restaurants and whatnot. And I can't help but wonder how long it's going to be before the fast food restaurants automate and put in machines to fry the hamburgers and the chicken patties and chicken nuggets and have you ordering off an ATM machine instead of a person at the cash register.
Yeah. You know, they already have to a large extent. I remember when I was a teenager working at Henry's Hamburgers that, you know, we had to fry the burgers on the griddle and flip them over with a spatula. And nowadays I think they put them on a rotating thing. It's like one of those toasters, you know, a long rotating belt that fries them. Although I could be wrong. I mean, I've seen the ads on TV, but anyhow, what does that have to do with the minimum wage? Nothing? No? Ed, you there? Lost Ed. Daniel in Houston, Texas. Hey, Daniel, what's up?
Hey, thanks, Tom, for taking my call.
Say what?
I'm glad I'm a proud sponsor of your program. And
Daniel, hold on just a second. Let me put you on hold, okay? I missed the time cue there. I was not. Hold on. We'll be right back. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com, of course, Ellen Ratner's charity for people in South Sudan, and free-don.org about Don Siegelman, America's political prisoner. Victoria, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Great to have you with us. So what's going on in the world today?
A federal judge today struck down Oregon's same-sex marriage ban, saying it's unconstitutional. State officials have said they'd be prepared to carry out same-sex marriages almost immediately, and couples lined up outside the county clerk's office in Portland in anticipation of the decision. Four gay and lesbian couples brought suit against Oregon's marriage laws, saying that they unconstitutionally discriminate against same-sex couples. Now, state officials refused to defend the ban, and the judge earlier denied a request by the National Organization for Marriage to intervene on behalf of its Oregon members. So an appeals court also refused its request for an emergency stay of the judge's decision.
Very,
so at the moment,
very interesting.
It looks like it's going forward.
Is this law in Oregon, or is it in the Constitution, and was it the result of a ballot initiative or passed by the legislature?
What I have from the Associated Press is very brief on this, and that's I've given you everything I've got.
Okay, cool. What's up? What else is up?
Well, very interesting. As you know, Georgia Judge Michael Boggs is up for the federal bench. And he's under a lot of attack in the Senate from Democrats because of his voting record as a lawmaker in Georgia on same-sex marriage, on abortion, and on the Confederate flag, and also on whether he's being particularly truthful about his voting record.
He's basically a fundamentalist right-winger. Why did Obama nominate him in the first place?
It was part of a deal on seven judges that he made with Georgia's two Republican senators. So in order to get the seven judges put forward, he had to get Boggs in there.
One of them had to be a crazy.
That's correct. So we've been waiting to hear what Representative John Lewis, the civil rights icon from Georgia, would say about this. And he has been largely silent on the issue for some time. He came out today, and it was thought that he might have made a deal to support him. But he came out very, very strongly and said, I fought long and hard and even put my life on the line for the cause of equal rights and social justice. And he said, I've worked tirelessly to rid Georgia, the South, and this nation from the stain of racial discrimination in any form, including the display of Confederate emblems in the Georgia state flag. I'm not about to change that position now. And he said his record is in direct opposition to everything I've stood for during my career, and his misrepresentation of that record to the committee is even more troubling.
Wow. So the two Republican senators from Georgia, I know Saxby Chambliss. Who's the other one?
The other one is blanking.
Yeah, okay. That's all right.
But Saxby Chambliss is actually retiring, which is interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Johnny Isaacson.
Johnny Isaacson, right. Isn't he the former governor or former congressman or something? I don't know. I remember his name from when I used to live there.
Yeah, Johnny Isaacson.
Yeah.
So what's interesting about this in particular is that Dick Durbin and Patrick Leahy have been waiting and wanting to talk to Lewis to find out where he stood on this issue before determining which way they were necessarily going to vote.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
So now they know.
Yep. So what else is up?
Oh, well, a bit of overseas news. This is on the inquiry in the UK into the Iraq war that, you know, has been going on. Sir John Chilcock's inquiry into the 2003 invasion.
Uh-huh.
Well, rather interestingly, a letter sent by Tony Blair to George Bush that is critical to the Iraq inquiry has gone missing from official White House records, it's been reported. And it's become a major stumbling block for Sir John Chilcock's inquiry. And the Cabinet Office says privately it wants to release as many of the Blair-Bush communications as possible. There's one letter which lawyers at the White House say they've not been able to locate. And this is a letter that's quoted from directly in Andrew Wansley's book, The End of the Party, following interviews with Blair's foreign policy advisor and then Britain's ambassador to the U.S.
Okay.
And this is a letter in which Blair is said to have told the U.S. president, you know, George, whatever you decide to do, I'm with you.
Oh, jeez. Bush's poodle.
And Bush's poodle letter. And it's gone.
Wow. And nobody knows when or where or how or anything.
Nobody knows anything. And the inquiry said it submitted 10 requests to the U.S. to publish material, including 200 cabinet-level discussions, 25 notes from Blair to Bush, more than 130 records of conversation. But they just can't find this letter, and everybody's frustrated because they want this inquiry wrapped up, and they can't wrap it up without the letter.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Very, very weird.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. I'm guessing there's probably a lot of information from the Iraq war invasion that has gone missing since the Bush White House, but
it's possible.
Just color me skeptical or cynical. Anyhow,
yes.
We have a minute left.
Occupy activist Cecily McMillan has been sentenced to 3 months in jail, also to serve 5 years probation for deliberately elbowing a New York police officer at a protest in 2012.
This is the woman whose breast was grabbed from behind by the police officer who was not dressed like a cop?
That's what she says. That's correct.
3 months in prison?
3 months in prison. She faced a maximum sentence of 7 years.
Yeah, but still, I mean, she should never have been convicted in the first place. This is absurd.
It's really fascinating. Now, her lawyers expect her to serve two-thirds of the sentence. She will receive credit for the two weeks she's been remanded at Rikers Island since being convicted.
Right. Remarkable.
She got there was a lot of support for her. There have been masses and masses of letters of support. There have been...
Yeah, it's a big deal. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And one of, not just one of my heroes and a guy I voted for president in 2000, but one of America's heroes, one of the guys who has helped shape this country into, in many ways, for absolutely for the better. The attorney, the consumer advocate, the five-time candidate for president of the United States, author of numerous books, including his most recent book, Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. And I think he's really onto something with this. Ralph Nader's on the line with us. Ralph Nader, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's always good to be a scholar, an author, and a talk show host extraordinaire.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Tell us, Unstoppable, why that title? What are you talking about?
Because there's a huge area of agreement in one sector of our reform after another in our country that left-right agree on. They've been divided and ruled by the corporate supremacists and their toadies in Washington, so they focus on their disagreements like reproductive rights, school prayer, gun control, so they don't focus on where they do agree and become an unstoppable force. Obviously, when you have left-right, starting with public opinion, then votes, then advocates, then it spills over into the election campaign, then it comes in on the incumbents in Washington and state legislatures. From left-right, it's an overwhelming majority, and it's unstoppable. I've seen it work in the past on things like stopping the military intervention in Syria, not humanitarian aid, military intervention, poured into Congress, emails poured into the House and Senate, 100 to 1, 60 to 1, 80 to 1, was unstoppable. It turned it around. And we've passed bills in the past, Whistleblower Protection Act, False Claims Act, beating the Clinch River Breeder Reactor, only because the people in Congress saw that it was coming at them both from the left and the right. And that's what they're terrified of. When they get a flurry of reaction from people back home, onto Congress, the senator says to the staff, where's it coming from? Left, right, liberal, conservative? And the answer comes back, I'm sorry to say, Senator, it comes from left and right. The senator turns white.
Yeah, yeah. Or some variation thereof. So in your book, you identify, correct me if my recollection is wrong, 27 areas where there are these left-right coalitions that we could possibly be working with, massaging, bringing to the fore to create this unstoppable force?
Well, the left-right alliance has moved from public opinion operationally in state legislatures now, spreading for juvenile justice reform, reducing those outrageous multi-year sentences for a teenager having a small amount of marijuana, for example. It's moving toward prison reform, taking on the prison industrial complex. You have Newt Gingrich and Grover Norquist on the right forming this group, Right on Crime, because why they say should a taxpayer pay to incarcerate nonviolent inmates who don't need that kind of incarceration for 5, 10, 20 years at $50,000 an inmate per year? We see it operationally now bubbling up from state and cities, which have passed higher minimum wages, to Congress, where now at least one party has taken this minimum wage restoration to $10.10 an hour from the 7.25 an hour that is now federal minimum wage into the Congress, and they're going to make it an issue. Comes in 70 to 80%. That's by definition a left-right alliance. We see it in the buildup against the NAFTA on steroids, this proposed Pacific trade agreement that Mr. Obama may ink and send to the House and Senate. It's not going to get through the House on fast track. In defiance of their leadership, John Boehner, Republican, Nancy Pelosi, Democrat, you've got a left-right alliance to block fast track. Right. And then the ones that haven't gone operational, that's what this book is about, how to move, turn the country around, stop feeling powerless and discouraged, lock your arms with people you disagree on A, B, C, D, but you agree on very, very fundamental WXYZ redirections to strengthen our democracy, our civil liberties, our opposition to crony capitalism, our opposition to corrupt money in politics, our proponent of supporting small business development. Instead of the big guys in Wall Street, you have community banks, credit unions. Instead of ExxonMobil, you have renewable energy back home, wind power, for example, solar panels. Instead of Pfizer and hospital chains, you have community health clinics that emphasize prevention. These are already spreading, by the way. They're reaching tens of billions of dollars of sales. But we need this kind of back-home displacement economy of these global giant companies that have no allegiance to our country other than control it and ship its jobs and industries to fascist and communist regimes overseas who know how to put their 80 cents an hour workers in their place.
Yeah. We're talking to Ralph Nader, the author, activist, consumer advocate, five-time candidate for President of the United States. Nader.org, by the way, is his website. His new book is called Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. Ralph, how do you deal with the fact that the American Legislative Exchange Council, this thing that was created back in the early Reagan years? Well, even let me go beyond that. Did you read by any chance the piece in the New York Times about the Koch brothers and how David Koch got involved in the Libertarian Party because of the 1976 Buckley essentially campaign finance loophole?
Yes, I just read it, that's how they got started into politics. They lost that battle, obviously, with the Libertarian candidates, but they learned lessons, and now they're surging forward.
Yeah, but it was that Buckley loophole. The Supreme Court was the first time, first in Buckley, then in First National Bank versus Bilotti, and then ultimately in Citizens United and McCutcheon, where the court said, money is not actually property, it's actually speech. And corporations actually, Abe Lincoln actually fought the Civil War to free the corporations. The 14th Amendment includes them. And apparently George Washington, fought the Revolutionary War to free the billionaires. I don't read it that way, obviously. I know you don't either. But with Alex still around, how do you take on this serious corporate money that is powerful enough? I mean, for example, in California, vast majority of people wanted to know if there were GMOs, genetically modified organisms, in their food. Vast majority. So they held a public referendum. Let's put it on the ballot. Monsanto and Dow and a bunch of companies come into the state, drop a few tens of millions of dollars into advertising, and the thing loses. How do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, the people who wanted genetically modified foods labeled in the supermarket, they spent $7 million, and the other side, Monsanto, probably spent $30 million. Very deceptive ads, but I don't think the strategy was all that great on our side. I think a little better strategy might have won it, opening up the Monsanto monstrosity. Instead, they didn't make Monsanto the issue. They just said, you have a right to know. Well, that's fine, but that's not enough when Monsanto's saying you're going to pay more for groceries, which is a completely false statement.
Right.
Other countries, including China and countries in Europe, have required labeling for genetic.
Well, we've repeatedly tweaked our labeling requirements, and it doesn't cause a sudden increase in prices of groceries.
That's
you know, sodium.
But look at where the Koch brothers are losing. Because big money only works for politicians who want to use it to get votes. But what if they can't get votes with big money? What if the votes are smart? What if they have a left-right alliance, as they are now in state legislatures in the southern states, to advance solar panels and the solar panel industry in neighborhoods around the southern states?
Right.
Well,
we
the Koch brothers representing oil and gas.
Ralph, we got to take a quick break here. Just hold on for just a few seconds. We'll be right back. We're talking with Ralph Nader. His website, nader.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ralph Nader's most recent book, Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. More with Ralph Nader in just a moment. Welcome back. Ralph, you're still here with us?
Yeah, I was saying the Koch brothers are interfering in these southern legislatures with money because they represent oil and gas interests. And they're now seeing solar panels, for example, as a real competitive challenge. It's no longer just Buck Rogers pie in the sky.
Yeah.
So they're trying to get state legislators to put a surtax on this net metering where if you have solar panels on your home, you have excess power, the electric company has to buy it back.
Right.
And guess what? The Koch brothers are losing.
I thought they just got that law passed in Arizona.
Yeah, but it's being challenged, and they're losing in places like Georgia. And they're going to lose because you got local business, local chamber commerce, local workers, and state legislators who like the idea of solar panels on their homes as well.
Right.
And then you've got this anomaly where the so-called anti-tax Koch brothers are pushing a tax.
Right.
You have Barry Goldwater's grandson, pretty conservative fellow, fighting on this very issue right across the South with his institute in Arizona. So when you get down off the abstract generalities of ideologies where people live, work, raise their families, there's a lot of fair play, a lot of survival issues, a lot of golden rule that operates. People don't get caught in these abstract ideological battles, which, of course, throughout history have manipulated people. People are manipulated not by facts on the ground so much as by ideological.
Here's one of the things I don't understand. There, many of these issues, these just simple bread and butter issues, and you and I have talked about this with regard to trade before, but you've identified a whole lot more than that. It seems to me that the first political party to come out and say we are no longer in favor of NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, and all these other trade agreements, we want to blow them all up and go back to the way it was before Reagan, we'll never again lose an election. I mean, Ross Perot got 20% of the vote, and he was a cranky billionaire who seemed rather odd, and Admiral Stockdale, who was running with him, was an honorable man but a lousy candidate, and he got 20% of the vote on this one issue. Why doesn't I understand why the Republican Party doesn't do it. They're wholly owned by corporate America. A large part of the Democratic Party is also wholly owned by corporate America, but a large part of it isn't. Why don't they aggressively go after some of these issues and make them theirs?
Short-sighted campaign cash. In other words, it's encapsulated in this phrase that the Democrats who want campaign finance reform always back off with this phrase. We're not going to unilaterally disarm against the Republicans for the coming election. And then it's always a coming election.
Right.
They don't have a long-range view. You're right. This is a winning issue. We've exported, because of NAFTA, WTO, and other shenanigans of the global corporations, millions of net jobs. How do we know that? Because for over 30 years, the U.S. has had a bulging trade deficit with foreign countries, which means that we have bought from abroad far more than we've sold abroad, and that's the definition of exporting jobs.
Yeah, yeah. And beyond that, I would say the average American gets it. Okay, we got to take another just very, very short break here. We're talking with Ralph Nader. Ralph, we'll be right back with you. Hang on. The attorney, the consumer advocate, five-time candidate for U.S. president, and his new book is called Unstoppable. Mr. Nader here, really on to something here. Unstoppable, the emerging left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state. We'll be right back with more of Ralph Nader. Nader.org. Tom Harmon here with you, and Ralph Nader on the line with us, the consumer advocate, the guy who changed America. You know, Lewis Powell cited you, Ralph Nader, in his memo in 1971 to Eugene Sindor, his friend who ran the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, as the threat to American business, your book on Safe at Any Speed. And you really have done so much over the years in this country. It's so great talking with you. So we were talking about how the Republicans are wholly owned. This is me speaking, not you. The Republicans are wholly owned by corporate America. The Democrats are half owned by corporate America. And I'm wondering why the Democratic Party doesn't just sit down with your book and say, okay, we're just not going to talk about guns anymore or abortion anymore. These are the things we're going to talk about. And if somebody asks us a question about abortion, we're going to answer by talking about trade. If somebody asks us about guns, we're going to answer. Because, you know, the press these days, they're such lapdogs. They don't, you know, three-quarters of the time, the answer they get from a politician isn't the answer to the question anyway. So, I mean, you know, why doesn't the Democratic Party just pick this stuff up and run with it?
Well, they're starting to pick up the minimum wage issue after I urged them in 2009, 10, 11, 12. They lost the House in 2010, 2012, because they wouldn't champion, watch this, they wouldn't champion 30 million American workers who are making less today than workers made in 1968, inflation adjusted. There's a lot of votes there.
Yeah.
They didn't stand for them. They put their hand out to the corporate cash register. And this book is designed to get things done, is to motivate the American people. They lock arms left, right. They get a big morale boost, and they know they're going to win if they do that. And this book is for readers, thinkers, and doers who are really serious about the country's future. Let's face it. You don't need more than 1% or 2% of real active citizens spread out in congressional districts reflecting massive public opinion to turn this country around. It's easier than we think.
Yeah. Well, history shows that. I mean, in some ways, it can be long and grinding and multi-generational. But on the other hand, once we hit a critical mass where people are convinced that, you know, change has to happen, it can happen really fast. I mean, the 26th Amendment of the Constitution took 3 months and 8 days to pass, you know, to lower the voting age.
And left-right turned Reagan around to start negotiating nuclear arms agreements with Gorbachev of the Soviet Union. He saw well-dressed really? Republicans walking down in these massive marches in New York and Washington. I've got a lot of examples in the book. We're going to have a unprecedented conference on the theme of this book, Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State, on May 27th in Washington, D.C. It's going to be attended to by libertarians, conservatives, liberals, progressives, and we hope to be able to stream it so more people can watch it. I sent the book to Obama. He hasn't responded yet. But you're right. We're going to have a left-right event on Capitol Hill so that this thing gets moving. Usually Congress and the White House are the last to hear the message from back home.
Yeah, I've noticed that. But eventually, I mean, if the parade gets large enough, this is what politicians do. They jump out in front of it with a flag and say, this is my parade. You know, they suddenly get religion. And so our job, our work, not just you and me, Ralph Nader, but the work of the people who are listening to us and watching us right now is to say this is our work, too. And we're going to get behind these issues and start pushing for them.
We want to take these politicians who are giving people the middle finger and change that into the forefinger to the wind. And that wind is going to be blowing left-right alliance from back home.
Yeah.
Again and again, they want to break up the big banks, too big to fail. They want to have Main Street prevail over Wall Street. They want these giant corporations to be loyal to this country since they were bred to profit and saved by taxpayers and defended by Marines overseas.
Right.
You know, there's a big... And that's why all these issues have been kept off the table, because they're potentially hugely displacing of the power of the few over the many. And that's what we're really focusing on. We have to get serious. Not all that many of us,
yeah,
but enough in each congressional district.
But at the same time, we need some truth telling in our media. I mean, right now, AT&T is talking about buying DirecTV, and the reason you and I both know this has got nothing to do with you know, the survival of either company. It has to do with monopoly power. You know, you get big enough, you can lock everybody out of the marketplace, all the competition. But listen to this. This is just about a 20-second clip here, Ralph Nader. Listen to this way that NPR presented this story this morning. Listen.
If you've streamed a movie or a TV show recently, you are part of the problem facing cable and satellite providers. These companies are facing more and more competition from internet streaming, and to survive, some are consolidating. Yesterday, AT&T announced that it is buying the satellite TV provider DirecTV. The deal, which still needs to be approved by government regulators, would be worth nearly $50 billion.
Now, NPR wants you to think that AT&T needs to buy DirecTV in order to survive. I think they'll survive just fine without doing it. How do we deal with this kind of, I mean, you know, basically NPR, they were reading AT&T's press release.
Yeah, well, you see, he used the word government regulators instead of government anti-monopoly Justice Department lawyers. He missed the monopoly issue. Completely. I mean, when you have two giants like that merging, it's what Adam Smith said. Watch out when you have business people surrounded in a table. They're doing the public no good.
Yeah. It just makes me crazy. And it's not just NPR, obviously, but and NPR used to be better about this kind of thing. They've gotten really, really bad.
Well, people got to talk to NPR. They're tilting very much toward conservative right-wing spokespeople, more like corporatists. But, you know, look at every 5 or 10 minutes, they're appealing to ads by businesses.
Right.
And look who supports some of the PBS, you know, for years, AT&T supported PBS, they have ExxonMobil, Chevron. After a while, you know, it gets into the NPR, PBS culture. They need to hear loud and clear from the taxpayers and from their viewers and listeners.
Yeah.
And this book is tailored to get people moving, to replace their hopelessness with a real dynamic drive.
You're absolutely right. And the book is unstoppable. The book is unstoppable. The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle a Corporate State by Ralph Nader. And you got to get this book. Nader.org is the website. Thank you, Ralph.
It's in the bookstores, too.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And as Ralph said, the book is in the bookstores right now. Check it out. Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. 28 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you on The Place Where Despair is Not an Option. Teresa in Santa Rosa, California. What's on your mind, Teresa?
Hey, Tom. I'd like to talk about education.
Okay.
Okay. Now, I've been raising kids here 24 years. I have them between 24 and 13. I even have one child who has severe special needs, and I've had all the schools. I've had private schools. I've had parochial schools. I've done the charter schools, the public schools. And my number one complaint with all the schools is income disparity. The rich parents don't want their kids sitting next to my kid because their mommy is a janitor. I'm living out loud. I freely admit that I'm a janitor, and people are really upset about that. Hey, I don't know why my $60,000 a year is no good at their private school. Just because they might make $180,000 or $200,000 a year doing whatever they're doing, I don't even care. But the point is that even some teachers try to exclude your child if you have an unfavorable job.
Wow.
Now, you know what, Tom? It's not just that. That's the biggest problem I'm identifying, is income disparity. My number two problem is, in the public schools, it's overpopulation. They have so many kids in those classes, teachers are picking winners and losers. And then the schools, they have no continuity. It makes no difference whether it's a public school, a charter school, a parochial school. They don't teach math the same in every school. So you might get something like good English in one school, but terrible math classes. And so if you're a parent like me who will buy books for food in the house, then your child will get the tutors and your kid will go to college. But if you're a parent who says it's more important for me to have a 401k or it's more important for me to be a homeowner than for my child to have a proper education, then you're not going to be able to supplement that.
Right.
And your kid will not go to college. That's all I really want to say about education.
I think you said it very well, Teresa. And it's a perfect bookend to my rant about the other, you know, the far more extreme piece of this, which is how poverty is the, when you filter out everything else, you can filter out every other variable. The major predictor of success in education is the wealth of the parents. And we live in one of the most disparate societies, one of the least equal societies, one of the most unequal societies, fully developed society, actually the most fully unequal, fully developed society in the world. And we got some, you know, small third world piker dictators, you know, who beat us. But among the developed countries, we're the worst in this regard. And it shows up in our schools. Teresa, thank you for the call. Very well said. Rick in Wilmette, Illinois. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to mention something about Route 66, the TV show that you mentioned from the 60s.
Yeah.
I happened to have grown up. I grew up near Route 66, so it had a double impact on me when I was young.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I remember that I didn't hear you mention is the two characters in that show that drove around from small town to small town always found a job.
Yeah, Martin Milner and George Maharis. You're right. You're right.
They found a job in every little town.
You're right.
Try to do that today.
Yeah, and they would work it until they made enough money that they could head on to the next town.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's amazing. The show was on the air from 60 to 64. Back then, nobody doubted that you could get a job. I mean, you know, if you had a high school diploma, even if you didn't, you could get a job in America. Excellent point. Rick, thanks for calling and making it. It was George Maharis and Martin Milner, and get my kicks on Route 66. Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Nick in Hampshire, Illinois. Hey, Rick. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Oh, Mr. Hartman, excuse me. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to ask you a few questions that maybe you could answer me about trade policy. Now, you've talked a lot. You're one of the only guys who will get out there and talk about our nation's trade policies. And I was wondering what we could do to encourage companies to move back to the United States while also keeping in place meaningful environmental regulations. Now, I only ask because one of the major influences of European countries coming back to the United States is because in the short term, our energy price, well, with the energy boom in places like North Dakota, our energy prices are going to be very low for the next few years. So how would you address something like that?
We used to have a trade policy. And by the way, this is the introduction in the first chapter of a book I wrote called Rebooting the American Dream. And I'm saying that not to pitch the book, because the book is online for free over at truthout.org. It's also in bookstores, but you can read it for free at truthout.org. Because all the documentation, all the footnotes, all the background of what I'm about to tell you is there. And so, when George Washington became president of the United States, when he was literally standing out in his field and General Knox rode up to him and said, George, the Continental Congress just met. We are now a country and you've been elected president. There were two things he wanted to do. One is he wanted to say goodbye to his mother, and she died just a few months later, so it was a good thing he said goodbye to her, and he knew she was dying. And the second was he wanted to get a suit of fine clothes made in the United States. Up until that point, the British had been practicing a practice which they're very good at. This is, you know, Gandhi, the whole spinning wheel thing. This is the exact same thing. It was illegal to make fine clothing in the United States when the British occupied this country. You had to buy it from England. We would grow the cotton here. We would grow the wool here. You ship it to England. It was made into fine clothing. The fine clothing was sold back into the United States. There was a guy by the name of Daniel Hinsdale up in Connecticut who was running a bootleg fine clothing operation. And after the Revolutionary War, he kind of came out and started running a retail operation. He was the only guy in America who was making dress clothing that, where you could buy it. And General Washington sent General Knox up to Connecticut to, you know, gave him his measurements and said, go get me a suit that I can be sworn into wearing. And Knox did that, and Washington was sworn in wearing a brown American-made suit. The portrait that was made of him the next day, he was wearing black English-made formal wear, but he was actually wearing an American-made suit. He understood the importance of manufacturing. And so he went to Alexander Hamilton, his Secretary of the Treasury, and said, how do we create manufacturing here in the United States? Because if you don't create things, if you don't make things, you can't. I mean, this is what Adam Smith referred to as the wealth of nations. Adam Smith, the example that he gave was there's no inherent wealth or value in a stick laying on the ground, a tree limb. But if you carve it into an axe handle, if you apply human labor to it, it has a value, and that value can even be passed down from generation to generation. And so Washington got this. And so in 1791, he became president. 1793, Alexander Hamilton presented to, excuse me, in 1791, Hamilton presented to the Congress. He became president in 1789. In 1791, Hamilton presented to the Congress what was titled Alexander Hamilton's 11-point report on manufacturers. And it was 11 specific things that America should do to become a great industrial nation. Washington endorsed this, and by 1793, virtually all of these had been made law. The most important ones were, number one, support to new and emerging and important industries. Today we would call this like subsidizing the solar industry, number one. Number two, tariffs, trade tariffs. If you can make something, if you can make a pair of jeans in, or a pair of shoes, let's say, which is the example actually that Hamilton used in one of his commentaries on this. If you can make a pair of shoes in Connecticut with a dollar's worth of labor, and you can make that same pair of shoes in Mexico with 30 cents worth of labor, then when those shoes from Mexico hit the U.S. border, there should be a 70-cent tax on them. If you can make them for 10 cents worth of labor in China when they hit the U.S. border, there should be a 90-cent tax on them. So you have selective tariffs product by product, and there's over 22,000 tariff categories right now that the U.S. government holds, or the Department of Commerce holds, that so that no matter where you make something, it costs the same once it gets imported in the United States. That was put into place in 1793 by George Washington and stood until the Reagan administration. And that's why we used to make things in the United States. The average tariff from 1793 to 1980 was around 33-34%. It got as high as 35-36% during World War II. It had at various times been as low as 29%, but it was always in that range. The tariff, the average tariff, import tariff right now on U.S. on goods made overseas and brought in the United States is 2%. That's why companies are leaving the United States to manufacture things overseas. So I would just abandon all of these insane trade policies. And I would go back to what Alexander Hamilton proposed and George Washington put into place and every president of the United States until Ronald Reagan supported, and that is a tariff-based trade policy, which is, in effect, what is being done by China, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Germany, many of the EU countries. They just do it with the value-added tax, which is functions as a tariff, and that's a whole other rant. So I'm not so worried about enticing foreign corporations to invest in the United States. I'd like American corporations to start bringing their factories back to the United States. And if they're not willing to, you know, just get the hell out of business and let some other American entrepreneurs start making things in the United States. Nick, thanks a lot for the call. This is our trade policy. It's sick and it's broken.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And this is also one of the reasons why you need to contact your member of Congress in the White House and say, no, we're not interested in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, otherwise known as the Southern Hemisphere Asian Trade Policy, SHAFTA. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dave, listening on KTLE in Arcata, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Oh, Tom, I am convinced, and I have been for quite some time, as you may recall, that some very ill-motivated people have found themselves in elected office in power in this country. And I believe myself that the prime reason that that's now happening is that they've gained control of much of our electronics. They do have the ability, as Snowden points out, to invade our phones and our computers. They have more than that. They have the ability to go in and flip things at will. And so I don't know what you can do about it, or I, but I do think it's something we need to be contemplating, something we need to be aware of, that we are being hacked and violated by people who are misusing their powers. I think That has a lot to do with what our Patriot Act is all about. That's one man's opinion here.
Yeah, no, I don't entirely disagree with you, Dave. And in fact, these revelations about the kind of man-in-the-middle attack that the NSA is doing that Glenn Greenwald revealed yesterday or the day before, where he actually, when his book came out, he actually showed pictures of guys from the NSA opening Cisco router packages before they were shipped to companies overseas and installing chips in them that would allow the NSA access to, you know, the information that's going through them. Now you've got countries, around the world, and the president of Cisco wrote a letter to Obama saying, you got to put a stop to this. The NSA has gone too far. And I know that, you know, that's a piece of what you're talking about. A larger piece of what you're talking about is things like electronic voting machines. And I'm very concerned about all of those things. And I think that what's the old saying? Sunlight is the best disinfectant. We need to be talking about these issues. We need to be putting them front and center. And I do on this program regularly, and we need to be encouraging other people to as well. So that's Dave, you've been beating this drum for a long time, and I hope you call other programs about it as well. And keep up the good work and keep spreading the word. Good to hear from you, Dave. Thank you very much. Daniel, in Houston, Texas, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV system. Hey, Daniel, what up? I put you on hold earlier. I'm sorry. Welcome back.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I appreciate it. I wanted to say that in my experience here in Houston, there's no room for charter schools. When I was a little kid, during World War II, I was a little slow in school. I went to a school, Alamo School in Houston,
mm-hmm.
and I failed the first grade because I was slow. So my mother took money out of her pocket, which we didn't have much. Stuff was rationed. And by the way, you was talking about Victor Guard a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. Daniel, I need you to get to the point here pretty quickly.
Okay. If you're going to have private schools, have private schools and let the people pay for the schools. If you're going to have public schools, just make them public. That's it.
I agree.
Because
I absolutely agree. We should say that education is a right, and every child in America can go to a good public school.
I'm sorry?
I said we should say education is a right, and every child in America can go to a good public school if they want to. And if they want to go to a private school and they got the money, fine, let them. I'm not opposed to that. But that we should not be using tax dollars to subsidize private schools, which is what we're doing right now. And we're using it, and we're subsidizing religious private schools to the tune of hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars a year. That's wrong. Daniel, thank you so much. I appreciate the story and the comment. Thank you. Welcome back, Tom Harmon here with you. And Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. You wanted to argue with me about NPR? Really?
That is correct, yes, Tom, and thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to say here in the Chicago area, we've got three NPR stations, two of which don't air really any news-related programming at all. And the one station that we do have actually augmented that story that you were referring to earlier about the AT&T merger with the facts that, you know, this could create a dangerous monopoly. So we have journalists in our local public radio station that do effective journalism and do augment the stories that are brought forth.
Marty, you realize there's a difference between an NPR station and a community radio station?
Well, correct, but they're still NPR member stations.
Not necessarily. Typically, you've got one station that has an NPR basically license or franchise or whatever it is in every major market, every market. Then you've got other stations. You know, I can't speak for Chicago. I know when I lived in Portland, you had OPB, Oregon Public Broadcasting, KOPB, that was the big, you know, NPR station. And then you had KBOO, which was the local community station. And they carried no NPR programming. They carried a lot of other local programming. And, in fact, at various times and over the years, they've carried my program and not carried this program because we have a nonprofit version of it that's available to those stations. But the point is that they're very different animals. The community stations get no government funding at all.
Right, right. Well, I know as a fact, one of our local classical music stations does get government funding, and does host NPR programs such as like Piano Jazz and Live at the Met, and you know some.
Well, are you sure those are NPR? Because there's several different companies that provide programming to NPR stations. It may be coming out of an NPR radio station, rather than being syndicated by NPR itself?
I'm telling you, this is brought to you by NPR. These are like NPR programs. They're just not.
Well, that's fine. Marty, I think we're in the weeds here. What's your point?
So my whole point is that for like classical stations, they shouldn't have to like compete with like Britney Spears and like Jay-Z to be on the radio. You know what I mean? We should have a forum for public radio to put on, like my son goes to bed every day listening to the classical programming. That wouldn't be possible. We wouldn't be able to listen to that on the radio waves if it wasn't publicly supported.
You know, if this was 30 years ago, I'd agree with you, Marty. But right now, for $25, you can buy an MP3 player and load a bunch of good classical music into it for probably another $25 and put your son to sleep with it, and never again have to contribute to a radio station to do that for you.
That's true, but I think that there is a
So why are we supporting an infrastructure like that with our tax dollars?
Because I don't think that great programming, like I don't think that the classical and jazz stations would be able to survive if we didn't. And I think that those are part of our commons, and I think that should be something that we cherish. I think
the radio stations are part of our commons. The radio and television stations. But that ship sailed in 1996 when Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act. It's all been privatized, and I mean, you know, part of it, your local public radio stations are run by local boards of directors, but it's still, even though it's not for profit, it's essentially privatized, and it's not responsive to voters. It's responsive to its board of directors. So and when I tune in at NPR and I hear Heritage Foundation spokespeople and Cato Institute spokespeople and politicians, particularly Republican and right-wing politicians, making statements that have no basis in fact and not being challenged, or being treated very politely as if, you know, gee, this is very rational. There's no such thing as climate change or AT&T needs to merge with DirecTV because otherwise they won't survive. I'm thinking, why am I paying taxes for this?
And I completely agree that there are, I mean, that in situations like that, there aren't, there's no reason to be.
There has been a serious effort, Marty, over the last two decades to inject right-wing content into public radio and public television, and they have been successful. And it's time that people woke up and realized that there's sometimes some really good reporting, and they've got bureaus and people all over the world, and what's her name, the woman with the Italian voice who's always reporting from the Vatican. I mean, there's some good reports. But the fact of the matter is that increasingly NPR is becoming National Petroleum Radio. They're not challenging the status quo. They're not challenging they're not outing the Koch brothers. In fact, David Koch succeeded in getting the Corporation for Public Broadcasting for pulling down a documentary about him, you know, Citizen Koch. I'm very, very unhappy with the state of this. If we're going to have public broadcasting, it's going to be like BBC. It needs to be like BBC. It needs to be 100% government funded. It needs to be totally insulated from both corporate influence and government influence. And we have none of the above. And it's not working well in the United States, and that, you know, that's my take on that. So and therefore I think, you know, your real alternative programming there in Chicago is WCPT or in Evergreen Park in the Chicago area. You've got some progressive stations out there that are doing a really good job, and you've got community stations now that are starting to take on NPR, and they're carrying Amy Goodman with Democracy Now, which is one of the best news shows out there. It so outshines NPR. It's startling. So, anyway, I'm ranting. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the news of the day, my take on it, and your take on my take right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And most importantly, don't forget, democracy just doesn't appear from anywhere. It's not a spectator sport. You've got to participate. Get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.